Welcome to episode 167 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Today's episode is the second of three in which we're taking a look at three lenses that I've picked up in the last few months and not had a chance to talk about yet. Last week we looked at the 135mm f2 prime lens. Today we'll take a look at some shots with the Canon TSE 90mm f2.8 tilt-shift lens. And in the final episode of the series, probably next week, we'll look at the 14mm f2.8L2 second version USM lens. Now though, let's jump right into it and take a look at some shots from the 90mm f2.8 tilt-shift lens. Those of you that have been listening for a while or have caught up on the archives will know that I spoke about my other tilt-shift lens, the 24mm, way back in episode number 13. And that was released at the end of November 2005, so that's 3 years ago. Although I still use my 24mm, when I first bought it, I was using the 20D. And then, you know, shortly after it upgraded to the 5D. And that was, you know, by the time I released episode 13, I was already using the 5D. Now, on the 20D, of course, you have the crop factor, which makes it basically a 38mm lens. And this is closer to the 45mm TSE lens, which is, you know, the third tilt-shift lens that Canon makes. I actually preferred this to the widest 24mm on the full frame. If I owned it. I was considering going for the 45mm originally. Because of the crop factor, that was the one that I decided to go for, the 24. And even this time, I seriously considered the 45 in the wide range, you know, the wider range, mid-range, I should say. Over the 90, but you know, I'd pretty much shot with that kind of angle with the 38mm that the 24 gives me on the crop factor for camera. So I figured that, you know, to sort of extend this range and experiment a little more, I'd go with the 90. And also I'd found more and more that I really wanted to isolate just a smaller part of the scene than I think even the 45mm would enable me to do on a full frame camera. So for now, you know, I think that the 90mm was the better choice. Like I say though, I do still use the 24mm lens. And actually, you know, one thing that I should mention is that when using these tilt-shift lenses, it can be pretty difficult to see where the focus plane actually is on a crop factor camera. At least it was with the 20D, as the viewfinder was pretty dark. If this is, you know, not so bad with the more modern crop factor cameras, then it might not be an issue. Once I moved to the 5D and the viewfinder was so much brighter, it became much easier to check the effects of the tilt mechanism and, you know, just sort of see much better where the focus actually is. Now, with the live view on the 1DS and you know, all of the modern range of DSLRs that are out there, focusing becomes much easier again, as we can now zoom in on the LCD and fine-tune the focus as necessary. Anyway, as with last week, we have a shot of the lens to start with, so let's bring up image number 2018 to see the TSE 90mm f2.8 lens on the left. Now, I actually didn't shoot anything with the TSE alone, so the lens to the right here is the 135mm that we looked at last week. I actually tilted the head of the TSE lens towards the 135mm, kind of making it look as though the TSE was sort of resting its head on the 135mm shoulder. Just a cute little tilt on reality there, I thought. It does, though, of course, let us see the tilt mechanism in action as well. And that is the extent of the tilt. So it's surprising that it allows you to change the focus plane to the degree that it does. In episode 13, you know, which you may want to listen to again if you're interested, I did go into some of, you know, a bit more detail in the mechanism. But today, just to recap, I'll go over it a little bit more. You know, starting with what TSC lenses are really for, or one of the main reasons why people get them, and then sort of, you know, the reasons why I bought one, well, the second one now as well. So tilt shift lenses for 35mm cameras were originally, you know, most commonly known for their application in architecture photography. The reason for this is because the shift mechanism enables you to correct the perspective distortion or the convergence, where, for example, if you're looking up at a tall building, the building tends to get narrower as it reaches up to the sky. And this is because, of course, you know, the subject plane is not parallel to the image plane, and your film or you know, the meaning, you know, the image plane meaning your film or your digital sensor. And you know, if we shift the lens upwards, basically just sliding it up in the lens mount, we can align the parallel lines and make the buildings look as though they're straight, you know, almost as though you were photographing it from further away, looking directly at it. In my opinion, if you make the lines perfectly straight, when you say really close to a building, it does look a little bit unnatural. And, you know, we're used to seeing photographs of buildings tapering off or leaning in or out. And so I don't use this feature that much. But, you know, this is, like I say, this is one of the original reasons, one of the original uses of these lenses. And whether you use that or not is really down to taste. Unless you're an architecture photographer, of course, and you probably want to get it spot on. When you're, you know, pretty close to a building, even if you shift the lens to remove the convergence, you may also find that your depth of field is too shallow to get the building in focus with a small aperture. If you need to use a small aperture, without a small aperture, if you need to use a wide aperture, then, you know, you can use the tilt mechanism with the shift mechanism to adjust the focus plane so that, you know, basically the focus is in line with the face of the building, and therefore have the entire building in focus, as well as the perspective or that convergence corrected. It seems like, you know, the tilt shift lenses are available for pretty much all of the makes of 35mm camera. It seems Nikon do them, and I'm sure the other makers. Of course, I'm talking about Canon here, but you know, if you're interested in this, you probably can find them for and, you know, pretty much any cameras are available, 35mm cameras available. Just have a look around. They've been out for years. I think Nikon released theirs in the 60s or maybe 70s, and Canon a little later. This is, you know, the mechanism, of course, that is kind of par for the course for medium and large format cameras that have the ability to adjust the height and the angle of the lens on the front of those big bellows that you know sometimes see. And it gets exactly the same results than you can get with the 35mm equivalents, and probably better, actually, because I'm sure that you can move it around a lot more. But, you know, I've never used a medium or a large format camera myself, so I can't really talk about that. It's just, you know, just from looking at photos and from what I hear. Anyway, the tilt mechanism refers to the action of angling the lens relative to the film or the image plane. And so, you know, basically, then if they're no longer parallel, then the optical axis of the lens is no longer at right angle to the film plane. With a tilt angle of zero, you know, no tilt at all, the image is focused parallel to the subject plane, and so that, you know, that means that it's the same as the film plane, and so there's no tilt effect. If you want to make an image containing objects that are, you know, at an angle to the film plane, such as, say, a line of trees, you know, going off into the distance, or, you know, the face of a tall building, as we were just saying, but you don't want to, or you simply can't achieve a wide enough depth of field to get all of the subjects in focus, then you can tilt the lens so that the focus plane is the same as that of the angle of the subject. This is not only useful when you're looking up at a building or something like that. You might be looking across the front of a building from one side. So by rotating the lens by 90 degrees, clockwise or anti-clockwise, you can tilt the focus plane across the front of a building, or like I say, along a line of trees, from right to left or vice versa, as well as upwards and downwards. Anyway, photographing architecture is just one of these, you know, the uses for these lenses, and not really the reason why I own them. I'm more interested in getting that miniature look, as though we're looking at a model of something. Basically, I've used the 24 millimeter lens for both. I have done a little bit of work, not so much architecture as in, you know, the standard architectural photography, but when shooting, say, the front of a building, things like that. But my real interest is in this miniature world look. And basically what that is if you use the tilt mechanism of these lenses to lay the focus plane across a scene in a place that it would not normally see it, apparently our eyes think that we're looking at a macro photograph with their shallow depth of field. And so we automatically think that we're looking at a micro world, not the real one. This effect is best achieved when you're looking down onto the scene from a height. And I haven't really gotten anywhere like that, with the shots that we'll look at today from the 90 millimeter. I have with the 24, but the ones that we'll look at today are not that good examples of this. Also, I'm using the focus plane in a different way in many of these shots. Again, not really emphasizing that miniature world look, still sort of having lots of fun, but maybe not emphasizing that look quite as much as I will do as I get into some high spots and look down onto scenes and things. Anyway, let's take a look at what I've been up to so far. First, let's look at image number 1970. This was shot behind the Meguro Fudōsan Temple, and I was literally just trying out the lens on the first day. I ended up here with a shot that I really quite like. The light was low at the end of the day, but also there was lots of contrast between the shade from the buildings to my left. The sun was a drop down low enough in the sky that the sun was behind the buildings to my left. But then there's also some trees and buildings in the distance that were quite bright because the sun was still hitting them. What this meant was that I was able to expose for the foreground, and we had that Torii gate there that we see in the bottom left quadrant. But everything in the background is very bright, so bright that apart from some very pale trees, there's no trace of the buildings behind the trees. And this area is actually quite built up with... there's a number of buildings behind there, but the exposure has totally removed them from the shot. You can see that I placed the tree along the right side of the frame here to frame the image. And not only along the right, but also there's a bough that's reaching across to the top of the frame. I have tilted the lens with the tilt mechanism so that the focus is vertical, and basically, in this portrait aspect, the focus runs along the gate. You can see that the gate is in focus, and then the tree behind it on the left side of the shot, they're all in focus, and then the right side of the image is not. So, I opened the I left the aperture relatively small for this lens, or for me. At f5, and I really wanted to do that so that I could get the full width, almost the full width of the that gate there in focus. And that, like I said, that's pretty deep for what I normally would want to do with this lens. Just because I wanted to make sure that that whole gate was in focus. Let's look next at image number 1971. Here I stood on a footbridge looking along the road at twilight, and once again, vertical composition with the focus at about 90 degrees to the image plane running along the line of cars. Basically, you should be able to see that the line of cars there is sharply focused, with the exception of that light, the last white car that's just joining the queue. as that was moving during the exposure. If you follow the line of cars along the road, though, right the way through to the buildings in the distance, you can see that the buildings with the windows there are in sharp focus, despite the buildings, you know, either side of the road being blurred. This was shot with an aperture of f4, so this would obviously not have been possible. You just could not have got that depth of field with this light and that length of exposure, without moving the focus, so that it was pretty much, like I say, 90 degrees from the front of the camera and running directly down the middle of the shot. I'm not sure if this is conventional, but I've also been playing with moving the focus to a line other than that of vertical or horizontal, and basically got it sort of, you know, at an angle, as we can see in image number 1972. Here I was on the road looking down into the JR or Japan Rail station at Meguro here in Tokyo. For this, I again fully tilted the lens and then rotated it so that the focus ran along the platform, you know, along, you know, the train platform instead of horizontally. I waited a while until I got some people sort of walking along to this end of the platform. And basically this gives us a bit more of that miniature look world that I spoke about earlier. Again, at f4, this gives us just enough depth of field to get all of the people in focus all along the platform, but with the edge of the platform, if you look at this closely, actually being out of focus, and then the top of some people's heads is just starting to head out of the depth of field as well. But, you know, we are seeing a little bit of that miniature look here. In the next image, number 1973, we can see a train at the platform, and that's about a minute later. Here I adjusted the focus slightly to get the side of the train the actual windows on the side of the train sharply focused. The model effect is still there to a degree, so I'm relatively happy with the results. What I really want to do is to reshoot this with the train halfway out of the platform, with some people, you know, on this end of the platform, and you know, it doesn't happen so much, and it's only a quick thing, because if they've just got off the train, then the, you know, you can catch them walking away. And what I'm going to do is just go back to this spot one afternoon and see if I can get this. On the day that I shot this particular image, I ran out of patience points with the wife, so pressuring me to sort of move on, so I I couldn't get the images that I wanted. But I was, you know, like I say, I mean, I push my luck a lot anyway, and so I'm going to probably visit this one and, you know, try to capture a slightly different shot at some point in the future. In image number 2005, we see a view outside the Canon S Tower in Shinagawa with a load of yellow ginkgoed leaves in the lower level. And here what I've done is tilted the lens horizontally and focused so that the plane of focus runs along the walkway and the footbridge that you can see that runs along the top, you know, from the right to left of the frame. Again, this gives us a little bit of a miniature world look with the people sort of all small there on the bridge and the blurred trees below. This one I shot at f3.2 to get a shallower depth of field, basically to avoid getting the tops of the trees in focus. Back at f4 in image 2006, I'd composed the shot and put the focus along the right side, lined up with the reflections of the lights outside the cafe, then waited for someone to walk into the shot. I'd also shot another one with a mother walking up the stairs to the left there with her daughter, a small child. But I preferred this shot. I was actually hand-holding for all of these, which makes it slightly more difficult to compose, and you have to get the focus, pretty much where you have to rely just on the viewfinder, the old-fashioned way, because, you know, there's no live view. You can't really look at live view, because by the time you've gone back to looking through, you know, your viewfinder, you'll move things slightly, so you're not going to get any real benefits from using live view if you're hand-holding. Still with the full frame camera, you can see the focus a lot better than with a crop factor camera up until the 20D. I imagine it probably hasn't, things haven't changed that much. But you can see with a full frame camera, you know, where the focus is falling, and turning the focus ring when you've got the tilt fully applied, basically moves the focus from right to left across the image. It's a pretty weird look when you do that. Even if you never buy one of these lenses, if you ever get a chance to sort of stick one on the front of a camera in a shop, I do suggest that you tilt it, you know, whack it right over to one side, and then just have a play around with the focus ring. All of these lenses are manual focus, by the way. I think that it would be asking too much of the manufacturers to make an autofocus version of these. And basically, you know, you need that full control. So they're all manual focus only. In the final image for today, also shot near the Canon S Tower, image number 2007, we can see that I have again tilted the focus vertically, and I'd purposefully positioned myself to align the tree in the bottom of the frame with the pillar in the building in the back of the shot. I was really pushing the ISO here as well, up to 1250 for this image, as it was quite dark by this point, and as I say, hand-holding. But this meant that the lights on the ground were all sort of on, you know, because of the darkness, I mean, not the ISO. You know, the lights were all on, and, you know, a little bit of added interest down the bottom of the shot there. And the lights in the buildings were now pretty much the only light source left. Once composed, I again waited for people to populate the shot along that top walkway there. And I also waited until they were relatively evenly spaced. While doing that, I'll shoot a few shots, just trying to make sure that I don't walk away with nothing. But my vision was to have people sort of evenly spaced across the top there. And this is as close as I got it. Not perfect, but, you know, having shot a number of frames here and having to leave, I was happy to get this one with people relatively well spaced out. Thinking about it, you know, it also helped that it was a little drizzly on this day, because that helped to get a little bit more contrast and reflection on that paved area at the bottom of the at the bottom of the shot around the trees, and that probably helped to bring out those lights across the bottom as well. So that's it for the example images. I have to say I'm looking forward to revisiting some of the locations that I've been to in the past and wish that I had a longer TS lens. I'll probably bring you some more shots later as I manage to shoot them. And in fact, you know, what I'll do is, you know, as you listen to this podcast from the archives in months or maybe even years to come, there'll be a link in the show notes that will always show images that I've shot with this lens. So if you look now, there's a few pages of images. But if you look, later on, the more I add, obviously, the more pages, but things will automatically get updated to that. Remember that you can actually go to, or you can list all images that are shot with any particular camera body or lens by clicking on the links that are on my profile page at martinbaileyphotography.com. Just select photographer and equipment profile from the gallery menu. And, you know, down the bottom there, there's a link, a whole load of links for the gear that I use to shoot with. Anyway, again, I'm very happy with this lens for what it is. I should mention that sharpness does take a bit of a hit when you start to twist this lens around. You can get pretty good results most of the time, and definitely acceptable. Unlike the 24mm, this is not an L lens. I can live with it. And in all fairness, even the 24mm being an L lens, it's, you know, once you start to really tilt it to the extremes, it can get a little bit soft. So, you know, all in all, pretty pleased with the image quality. And all said and done, that, you know, they're both a lot of fun and well worth sticking, you know, in the camera bag when you're going somewhere where you think you may be able to use them. Of course, there's going to be times when you go out just to shoot with these lenses. I often, if I'm going shopping or something, and I'm just going to be wandering around town and think I might be looking over an area where people are walking around, then I'll put one of these. I'll probably take both now, but I'll put these in my bag as well as a standard zoom or something, And that way you can, if there is an opportunity to get some shots of looking down onto something, then you know, you're prepared. Of course, there are other practical uses for these lenses. You know, I also explored this a little bit in episode 13. You know, like even for nature or landscape shooting, you can sometimes need pan focus, and that's when you know the scene is in focus from front to back. But you can't achieve this with just by going to a small aperture. So what you can do is you can use these tilt shift lenses to achieve that by laying the focus down across the scene. And you basically use this, for example, to shoot a bed of flowers, which is the example that we looked at in episode 13. You can also use it, say, to shoot a waterfall from the bottom and then correct the convergence, much the same as a tall building. And you can also, adjust the plane of focus there, that will be the subject plane. Laid across the subject plane, so that it runs across the face of the waterfall, and then if you wanted, say, a faster shutter speed with a wider aperture to freeze the water of the motion, then that would allow you to do so. You could use a relatively shallow depth of field, but then sort of lay it across the front face of the waterfall that you're looking up at. There are many ways in which to use the tilt and shift mechanism, and remember that they can all be used together as well. I don't think it's on the 45, but on the 90mm, there's no limit to how far you use both. On the 24mm, though, there's a little red zone on both the tilt and the shift notches. There's a gauge there, and that's basically if you have one into that red zone, then you can't take the other into the red zone or something like that. But I believe that's really just to stop the vignetting that you get, you're probably, the image circle becomes goes a little too far off center. But I've used it at both extremes, and it's all just good fun. So by all means, if you want to have a play with the 24 as well, then it's still a great lens. And, it probably is the lens if you want to take a sweeping landscape in pan focus. All in all, though, as I say, very happy with this new addition. I'm enjoying the angle of view, and I think I can probably keep my hands off the 45mm for a while. So let's start to wrap it up a little bit there. There is a few things that I wanted to touch on, a little bit of housekeeping before we finish. Firstly, I mentioned last week that I'd put a book together on blurb.com, which is 12 photos from each of the participants of the 2008 Hokkaido workshop. And there are some snaps of the group as well at the back, having some fun. I was waiting for my first copy to arrive to check the quality, and luckily it arrived today in time for this week's podcast. And I have to say that I'm pleased with the results. Some of the pages are dark, very dark pages. I've got a little bit of marking there. It's definitely not top class printing, but as a memory of the trip, and the most of the photography has been reproduced very well. I'm pretty happy with the results. And there was one possible problem. A lot of people have spoken about some color casts in the images because Blurb doesn't really or readily provide any profiles for you to export your images with. So you basically submit all of your images or you put the book together using sRGB as the color space. And so I was a little bit worried about that, but there's no color cast at all. And, many of the shots look really, really nice. Apart from, like I said, it's just some of the pages had, it looks as though there wasn't quite enough ink had been applied to the totally black pages. But apart from that, that was only on a few. In general, it's very, very good quality. And so I'm going to be going away now and ordering a bunch more for people that I owe a copy. I did make a few changes after this. I actually changed the layout very slightly. I'm glad I only ordered the one copy to begin with. But like I say, very, very good. And I will be going off and ordering a bunch more copies now. to give to people over here in Japan that I owe copies. I'll probably send a copy to my family as well. So the other thing I wanted to talk about is that I've put together a Cool Iris, I don't know if I'm saying this right, Cool Iris or Cool Iris. I imagine it's Cool Iris as in the iris of the eye. Basically, I've put a Cool Iris feed together on my website so that you know, you can go to the top page of my website at martinbaileyphotography.com and basically click on that. There's a link there. I'm going to tidy up the link and probably put a little icon in or something. But look for a Cool Iris link on the top page. You'll need the Cool Iris plugin. So it's basically just cooliris.com. So go there, grab the browser plugin. The install's pretty straightforward, and then you're set up to view what is really some amazing technology. You know, basically when you click on the link on my top page, then you get thrown into a full screen viewer that is basically just displays what they call the wall. And it's literally a wall of images in a virtual space that you can move along by dragging with your mouse. If you drag on one of the background areas and then just flick it off to the left or right, basically the faster you move your mouse, the more acute the angle of the wall becomes, and then it sort of whooshes by you with all of these image thumbnails there. And if you click on an image, you display the larger a larger version. And then if you press enter or hit the full screen icon in the bottom left of the user interface, it displays that image at full screen. And you know, both the very large image and the sort of intermediate size are both actually, you know, at least on my website, they're larger on the screen than the actual images are, you know, the originals. But I'm really impressed with the algorithms that they're using to embiggen the images. It's just, you know, very, very sharp for when you consider that the images are only 700 pixels wide. So, you know, it's pretty cool stuff. Very, very good technology. So grab the plugin from cooliris.com, then go to the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com and click on the Cool Iris wall link that I have there. And, you know, especially if this is the first time you've played with this technology, I know you're going to think that it's really cool. So do try to check that out when you get a chance. So that's it. I'm going to sign off for now and catch you next week. For now, you have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.
PhotoCastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotoCastNetwork.com.